Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome back to the Lantern Rouge Cycling Podcast, presented by Zwift. For the second rest day recap of the Vuelta, there was actually a transition day, so it's their third day off. And we'll review the week that's passed. We'll catch up on Tour de l'Avenir, talk about the new Belgian super talent, Remco Evenepoel's old news, mention the Tour of Britain first stage and Maryland Cycling Classic yesterday. So lots to talk about, particularly whether Evenepoel can hang on. But the week that's been, stage 10, Evenepoel wins the TT, 50-second gain. Stage 11, Groves gets his first Grand Tour win. Carapaz, Estepona beats Vine and co. In the heat. Stage 13, Mads Pedersen, little uphill finish. Then Pandero. Evenepoel loses that 50 seconds he gained in the TT. Straight back to Roglic. Carapaz wins again. And Aronson wins yesterday on Sierra Nevada, which kind of had small gaps for the Queen stage. Evenepoel only losing 15 seconds. So a big week. It feels like, to me, the parkour is suggesting at Benji that the Welter's crammed a lot of excitement into, or action into, the first 2 weeks. And Evenepoel, I'll just remind everybody where he stands. He's 134 ahead of Roglic in second, 201 ahead of Maas in third, a big gap, 449 then to Ayuso in fourth, Rodriguez in fifth on 516, just 8 seconds ahead of Lopez, Almeida on 7 minutes, 5 seconds ahead of Arensman, O'Connor in ninth on 857, Hindley in 10th on 1136. Apart from Evenepoel, who should be happy, is Enric Maas and Movistar happy with their third spot, Benji? Are UAE happy with fourth? Are Ineos happy with fifth? What do you think these sort of teams in that region are talking about on this rest day?
I think the riders that are in third, fourth, and fifth position are likely, first of all, trying to see whether the third spot is obtainable. For Maas, that is one that he's going to try and defend for certain. For Ineos and UAE, that's arguably one they're interested in. They want to try and attack that in some shape or form. That's how I see their routine here. But when it comes to Maas, there's also the aspect of he was the strongest GC rider when it comes to finishing on the road, the fastest on Sierra Nevada. He beat Lopez, he dropped Roglic, and Evenepoel on that climb, and Yuzo dropped as well. Like, so Maas must be hoping for more, but we'll go into the parkour in a bit of week three, and the viability of Maas doing that is not really there unless there's a bad day in one of the other competitors. And then you come towards a Jumbo-Visma when it comes to Roglic. And the question there is different to me because it's odd, you know, he's won this race 3 years in a row. And you want to ask yourself, is he fine with a second spot? Is Primoz Roglic fine with getting second at this race? And I don't think he's going to be overly happy with getting second at this race. So it wouldn't shock me if he tries something that is out there, that is more from further on one of the stages, perhaps a stage 20, where opportunities arise and he might try and benefit from it. But again, parkour wise, is there opportunities for that? We'll go into it in a bit. But are you also thinking that Roglic is more willing to risk it all just to get that victory?
I think so. I mean, does second really matter to him? I'm not sure. The parkour, though, and his team makes it difficult in this third week. I agree with what you said about Maas. Like, when I think about it, he finishes this, the same distance behind Roglic on this second proper rest day as at the first rest day, which to me is crazy. On the first rest day proper, he was in second on 30 seconds plus ahead of Roglic. Sorry, I misspoke. I mean, after the TT, he then moved into third, 20 seconds back, and to have been strong enough to go with him on Pandera and then dropping him on Sierra Nevada to only be sitting 20 seconds back, I think they would have wanted more from those legs, and it's going to be tough to overcome Roglic on the terrain coming up. Before we get to that, maybe a rest day for the riders, but it's the perfect time to get on Zwift. I'm going to be hopping on straight after this. You can see me hydrating as always throughout every episode, constantly drinking about three different things. And indoor season is here. Just went past my neighbors. They're about 80 years old. They speak to me in Catalan only. I speak to them back in Spanish. Do we understand each other? Maybe not pretty well, but it's autumn. It's Zwift season. You know why? Because they're foraging for mushrooms, huge in Andorra and Catalonia. And so it's not just the fact that it's September. It's if my neighbor has mushrooms, it means it's time to hop in on Zwift. So new updates rolling out, the ability to chase your PB ghost across segments, a new race series, all landing soon, plus, of course, Zwift Academy. Time to sign up for that, particularly if you're in the Southern Hemisphere looking for a pro contract. For more information or to start your free 7-day trial, head to Zwift.com. Do people forage in Belgium, Benji? Like, what's like for mushrooms and stuff? Is that a big activity?
How am I supposed to know? I watch cycling like 24/7. So I've got no time to watch other sports. I've got no time to go outside and see what people do in forests. So I can't tell you. I generally can't tell you what people are doing here in Belgium. So yeah, we're going to have to live with the uncertainty of Belgian foresting, I'm afraid. But I do enjoy your wonderful, wonderful story throughout the Zwift segment there. Let's get back to talking about the race. And I've got a question for you. We've spoken a bit already in this podcast about Roglic and whether he will be willing to go all out to take this victory again by attacking early and so forth. But do you think that Remco Evenepoel is currently in a position that he is not possible to lose his Vuelta anymore? Or do you think that he can still lose his Vuelta? And what does the parcours say in terms of Remco's ability to finish this in the red jersey?
Yeah, of course he can. He can lose the Vuelta, but it's a really, really soft parkour. I mean, when I want to look at the stage, for example, let's pick out a stage, stage 5 of Tour de Suisse. He had a shocker on that stage. He lost to Vlasov 2 minutes 12 on GC. And that's almost a harder stage. They did repetitions of like a 2.5K. 8% climb the entire time. I would say that we don't have a stage like that in the remainder of this Vuelta. So let's talk about what stages there actually are. Like stage 16, it looks like a Mads Pedersen stage. There's one climb, 1,500 meters, 6%. I mean, with 8Ks to go. So that's either break or a Pedersen sprint. The next stage, 17, 160Ks. There's one categorized climb. At the end, some little rollers that are like 3% before. And that's 9Ks, 5%, although it is 2.3Ks, 7%, followed by 4Ks, 7.5%. But still, this is like a 10, the last proper bit's like a 10, 11-minute climb. Like, Roglic could out-sprint him for sure, but we're talking seconds there. Stage 18, a little bit more dangerous, perhaps. It's Alto del Piornal, 190Ks. It's got some medium mountain beforehand, and then 13.6Ks, 5%, descent, 13.3Ks, 5.6%. I mean, like, these are climbs that, like, they go like 30 kilometers an hour on that. And then stage 19, the two climbs, 9Ks, 6%. That looks to me like breakaway or maybe Pedersen. And then stage 20 is the big danger, where we have multiple five categorized climbs, a cat 1, 9.2k, 7%, where people will attack him, they have to, and that's followed by 10ks at 5.6%. But what haven't you heard there is anything approaching double-digit gradients. He was dropped on Pandera on the steep section, he was attacked on Hazelanus on the steep section, and then at the end of Nevada. If he's he doesn't need to be in week one shape. If he's just in a Sierra Nevada shape and they don't fuck up majorly tactically, it's going to be extremely difficult for him to lose.
Exactly. It's the gradients that do it for me as well when looking at the parcours. You said it, stage 20, the Puerto de Navacerrada stage. It's intriguing because this kind of looks like the kind of stage we hope for in a Grand Tour, where we want those like medium mountains throughout the parkour to make sure that there's abilities for teams or riders that want to launch early. Like that, was it Torino stage in the Giro that Bora lit it up by having a rider in the breakaway, then bridged towards that breakaway and so forth and had the action eventually leading to a Simon Yates win that stage. Then last year, stage 20 of the Vuelta, where action happened early on, Button as a rider up front and tactical stuff happening in the GC group, Miguel Angel Lopez jumping into a car. Wonderful stuff happens on medium mountain stage. That's what I'm trying to get to. But those climbs that launched it were also climbs that were nearing 8% average for me. And I feel like there's only one climb that comes near those gradients on this parkour, on the stage 20, and it's that Morchuera climb, the second last. But I'm then asking, is that too close to the finish for anybody to endanger a 1 minute and a half gap towards Remco Evenepoel? He'd actually need to collapse on that climb for this to become beneficial for a Roglic to take the red jersey on this final mountain stage. So I find it hard to believe that the gradients that I see will damage Remco Evenepoel enough to make it hard. So I agree with you that he's currently pretty much the likely winner of this Grand Tour, bar any bad luck, punctures, crashes. We can't know that. Hopefully no COVID stuff and GC riders. That's what I'm hoping for. We haven't had many in the last few days, but it's also a rest day, so I'm scared for tomorrow. But also next to that, there's obviously the opportunity for tactical stuff to happen. We can have a stage where, let's say, for example, we're looking at stage 19, that stage where you say breakaway. I'm arguing when I see this is breakaway as well. But let's say someone lights up the first climb and we see no Quickstep riders anymore. Van Wilder has the day that he had yesterday on Sierra Nevada, which was dropping on Perky. Vrvanka has a bad day. Masnada, his crash yesterday, evolved into him not being too fine. Then teams can put pressure on him with multiple riders, but there's not that many teams anymore in GC that have multiple riders that can remotely endanger this man. So I think there's also the aspect that when such stuff happens, for example, let's say Almeida or Ayuso goes up the road and is in a breakaway. Let's say it's an Almeida. Another rider will chase them. You're right. And we saw that with Ben O'Connor and Thamen Arnesman yesterday. Like, that battle will also happen with riders in 6th and 7th and 4th and 5th and riders like that, causing them to defend their positions in 3rd and 4th. And that might benefit Remco in the final week because his team might not be needed to be required to take down every single time gap. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think it's kind of like Roglic last year. Like on stage 20, Jumbo Visma just kind of chilling. They're letting Ineos set the pace, others attacking. Roglic went with the final move, sat in, never had to pull. No problems. Denied Ryan Gibbons the win, and then Champassin won. But it's what Benji mentioned. Like, you look at that stage 20 last year, they were fake news climbs. You're saying, oh, they're 6%. No, no, no. Alto de Mugas was 5.7Ks at 8%. And then as a little bit at the top, they were perfect for moves because there was, and then Alto de Prado, 1K, 10.3%. And then it leveled off where there's steep enough gradients, 8, 10, 11% sections, where if you are better, you can get separation. And then you can, when it levels off, you have, if you're Jack Haig, Gino Maeder pulling for you, then Mark Pudun, and then it makes a big difference on the flatter sections. These climbs are not fake news climbs on stage 20 of this year's Vuelta. They are like as steady as they come. And so the question is, can Chris Harper pace hard enough on a 5%, 6% climb that's 13Ks long to drop, to have Evenepoel under such pressure in the draft that Roglic can just attack away and then gain huge time? And it seems very, very unlikely to me. The draft benefit is just so much. Now, the problem is week one. If Roglic was on 20 seconds, I think he wins this Vuelta with a pretty comfortable team, with a decent team, because he could clean up bonus seconds if they chase the break. There's perfect climbs for him to take bonus seconds as he did in stage four, but he isn't. 150 bonus seconds won't be enough, I don't think. So yeah, Evenepoel and Quickstep are in pole position, and I yeah, I still find it really, really hard to believe that he's not going to win. But anything can happen. Tour de Suisse, he collapsed in the heat. Probably he might do again. Who else is going to be the movers? Who is going to be... Obviously, we spoke about Roglic now. He's obviously going to try. Are you so going to try to get on the podium? Because to me, I don't care about fourth. I know it's a great result for a 19-year-old. You want to be on the podium. You want to try every stage to improve your position and not just be comfortable with fourth. He's been very unlucky, Ayuso. I think, yeah, I would like to see him go for Mas, but again, I don't really see where he can do it. It'll require Almeida, right, to bait.
Yeah, but I don't see that happening either. I feel like I low-key got the feeling that UAE is just trying to stack up that top 10 with their two riders and try and defend their positions each. It's also, there's still only 2 minutes between them. It's like they keep it close enough for Almeida to be able to be allowed to go for himself because he's still relatively close in GC and he's better than the amount of people that are trying to hop over him in GC when it comes to going in breakaways, hopping into the top 10, and they always end up just below Almeida in GC after doing that action. And we've seen that with Arensman yesterday as well, for example. 5 seconds behind Almeida, but on paper, Almeida's going to take time on him again on the climbs that come. But the thing for me is, I'm not looking at Ayuso here. I think Ayuso is going to be hard to take 1:48 back on Mas, unless he does something a la Plataforma de Gredos, Pogacar attack from far out. But there's no parkour like that mountain stage they had on stage 20 of 2019. That was an amazing stage with, like, was it not the stage where Pogacar attacked early, got a proper lead, and then Lopez crashed in the gravel in some descent or something, and oh, chaos everywhere. Loved it, that stage. But anyway, I wanted to talk about Carlos Rodriguez because I think Mr. Rodriguez will likely drop out of the top 5. I think Lopez will surpass him because Lopez is getting better and better. While the parkour does not suit him in terms of it's not a gigantic mountain at the end of each stage, I still think there's going to be like that one stage where Lopez can take some time on the Carlos Rodriguez and stuff. What do you think surrounding those two?
Yeah, I think if there's one where Rodriguez is looking a bit weak, it's like punching, and that would be stage 17. Where it finishes with 4K, 7.5%. And maybe if I was Lopez, I'd try Rodriguez there. If I was Roglic, I'd try and win that stage actually as well. And I think Jumbo should go for that. But yeah, I'm not expecting... It'd be interesting. We're sort of downplaying it. Maybe there is more to this parkour once they actually get into it. Maybe stage 20 is harder than we think. I don't know. I think it's very, very shallow stuff, and the aero bullet it suits him a lot. But tomorrow's stage, we should preview properly. Very, very odd. 191Ks, as I said, 1.5Ks, 6% climb, cresting, 8Ks from the finish. I think that it's like the Magnus Cort break that he'd always win last year. I think Trek should go all in for Pedersen. He's climbing so, so well, and I don't know. I think Groves can get over it too. So I think Bike Exchange have to pace for the points. They have to go for it. So I think this goes to the peloton. I think Pedersen wins again.
I think Pedersen is certainly the one that is likely going to be a rider that is high up on the favorites list for this. I am questioning whether there's like 600 meters at 8.3% in that final stretch. I'm asking, is there an option for a Jumbo to also try and get bonus seconds there? Or are we looking at a similar stage to what Pedersen already won, where it's more likely to end up being Roglic getting outsprinted by more versatile sprinters than a Roglic, for example, beating a Laporte in that Paris-Nice stage, for example?
Yeah, it's sort of similar. I guess there's no guarantee of crosswinds. That was also three climbs back to back. Roglic ended up taking 20 seconds and he could have taken 10 bonus. I'm not sure it's 6%. I guess there is steeper paths in it. Yeah, I mean, why not try? But the thing is, they don't have Nathan van Hooijdonk. They don't have Wout van Aert. They don't have Christophe Laporte. Can Dennis, Harper, Hesink, Omen do that pacing? I don't think they can. No knock on them. But like Laporte and van Hooijdonk are big guys who can hit it hard. So it's going to be difficult, and I think Trek will be pacing and trying to control. I think dropping Pedersen in his current form is going to be hard. I guess always there can be a Bergodeau counterattack on the top as well if there's a lack of control from somebody like a Luis Leon Sanchez. But I'm going with Pedersen.
I'm gonna let you go for Pedersen. I'm going to go with Ackermann in the hopes that Milano gets something right in getting that set up. And Ackermann, like, he's had proper uphill sprints before. And I hope I'm not underrating this finish by selecting someone like Ackermann. But Ackermann at his best this year, the best of this year, as in, like, Napoloni stage, for example, should be able to at least compete here. He was looking good on that one stage where Pedersen took him over because Ackermann read 500 meters instead of 200 meters, apparently. But and then he launched early. So let's hope he doesn't launch early. And let's hope he competes. Why not? I see that as a possibility.
Maybe it's super hard and it's like Impy, Bevan, Roglic sprinting, but I'm not sure. 8-9 Ks from the finish, that's a long time to hold a very slender 5-6 second advantage. But anyway, that's the Vuelta. Big third week coming up. Well, maybe not so big. Depends how they play it. I want to talk about now the big Belgian super talent, Jan Uytterbroeks, who won Tour de l'Avenir, which was, I think, the last couple of stages were televised. And he is 19 years old, born in 2003, which is terrifying. If you don't know, Tour de l'Avenir is an under-23 race, which is 9 stages. It's literally translated as Tour of the Future. It's like the under-23 Tour de France. And there's some big mountain stages. And generally, in the last 10 years, good performance in Tour de l'Avenir, if you're young, has been indicative of a very successful world tour career. And so Uytterbroeks, if you don't know, he joined Boerhansgrohe World Tour team this year, but he has mainly raced .pro and 2.1 races. He's only done the Astel Golds, his only World Tour race, and he was allowed to do a Tour de l'Avenir as a 19-year-old. So what's he called in Belgium, Benji? The next Evenepoel, or not the next Merckx?
I think the next Evenepoel was his first like nickname when he started breaking through, when he was, I think when he was still riding for like a Belgian local club before he went to Auto Eider Bayern, which was like the juniors team for Bora in existence. And first of all, it's Kian, not Kian. Just wanted to get that out there. Kian Uytterbroeks is his name. That's how you pronounce it. And I don't know if he's got like a Schepdal Scud like nickname yet. Haven't seen that yet. They're probably still trying to pronounce his first name properly in the first place. But I think you had a good nickname last time, Out of the Pans. That's a bit silly, though. I don't think we should make that a real thing for this man.
That's his literal name.
Yeah.
Isn't it?
roughly. But anyway, when it comes to him as a rider, I feel like we've seen quite some growth in the last period, as in, obviously, he did well at the juniors. Like, we can't really rate the juniors that much in the sense that, obviously, we can rate it. It was great, but I swear when Auto Eider Bayer, that junior team, was riding races, they were like getting 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 in some races left and right. And it became clear that that team had the strongest riders in the races that they were competing in, is what I would dare to say. Now, you often can question how riders' progression should be in those years, as in certain riders jump from a junior team straight to a World Tour team. Some riders have a junior team, then a U23 team, then a World Tour team, which is the old school progression of moving up. And we see that, for example, with, I think we can look at Jumbo Development Team at being a team that has basically youngsters through local circuits and through junior circuits go towards their U23 team, and that U23 team can ride lower end races that are on U23 level. And once riders are good enough, like Estonia Mitted, for example, the Norwegian on that Jumbo Development Team, then they start racing with the pros in an Algarve, for example, at the start of the year. I feel like Jan Uytterbroeks has done it differently because, well, Bora doesn't really have a U23 team right now. Well, they didn't have it at the time. I think they just signed a deal with Tirol and a different team, Lotto Kernhaus, Conti teams, to use them as like development teams in the future. But how did that work for Jan Uytterbroeks? Because I swear he went from just junior outweighed buyer straight to Bora, right?
So they did it slightly differently to Marco Brenner. So Brenner is a similar age. I think he just turned 20. He's a year younger than, I'm 6 months younger, sorry, than Arthur Brooks. He has done, he joined DSM in 2021, and he did Kerner, Romandy, Dauphiné, and some top pro races. And then this year he's done the Vuelta, Dauphiné, Romandy, done a lot of races, 60 race days so far, and he hasn't finished the Vuelta yet. At 20, no Tour de l'Avenir for Brenner, to compare him to the U23. So seems like with Bora have gone a little bit slower, and it's been good because we saw a Tour of Norway, as you remember, the greatest race ever. Aita Brooks came, I think, sixth on the mountaintop finish there, which was in front of Chavez, 1:23 behind Evenepoel. That was a very, very high-level performance. And in Tour de l'Avenir, he pretty much just replicated that. He also had a good performance in Sibiu Cycling Tour, where he came third on GC behind Aliotti, who I think did well in l'Avenir when he was in under 23. He's 23 years old at Bora. But here's how Aita Brooks did at l'Avenir. There was the first big mountain stage, big mountaintop finish, the Col de la Madeleine from Saint-François-Longchamp climb. It's basically up to where 13.7Ks, 8%. And by the way, all of this is in an article on lanternrouge.com.au with graphs and pretty easy to follow there. But it was a pretty hard stage by U23 standards for like 3.5 hours beforehand. France paced really hard, and then Aita Brooks with 10Ks to go just destroyed everybody and rode away. And Stalin admitted Michael Hessman on Jumbo Visma Dev for big guys. They were going pretty well, particularly Hessman. And Lenny Martinez, I think, struggled. So he did 5.88 watts per kilo for 41 minutes. And that's really, really good. He did 6.1, I think, for 31 minutes. So roughly the same curve, shorter duration in Norway. And that both those performances are comfortably within what a Grand Tour top 10 rider should be doing to get a Grand Tour top 10. Now, obviously, it's not just about that. You have to be consistent for 3 weeks, do it after hard stages, good TT, not crash, yada, yada, yada. But he's got the watts to be in that region already at 19 years old. And stage 8 was quite a hard, short stage with two long climbs. Again, I think he did 5.5 for 45 minutes. Not as good, but it's a bit harder. And then the last mountain stage, that kind of nothing happened. Went to high altitude and the GC group kind of stayed together. So he cleaned everybody up at 19. And yeah, I think that's better performances, by the way, than what Vlasov and Lutsenko did in the Tour on any climb, which people might be surprised by. So I don't. What do you think Bora should do with him? Knowing all that info, Benji, do you give him some World Tour GC targets now for next year?
Well, I think he's one Avenir. I don't think he needs to do three more Avenirs, despite him being able to do so since he's only 19. That would be pretty funny to do in like four Avenirs in a row. But I think the smarter idea is to build further on what they have built so far. They send him to some .pro races to try for GC. For example, Tour of the Alps, where he got 16. That's one where I'm like, that's interesting. Tour of Norway, the one you mentioned as well. Like, these races are interesting to see whether the rider can fight against the riders from World Tour that are also competing in these races, like in Norway and Sofov, to compare himself to an Evenepoel or a Plap or a Vine, for example, in that race. And he was holding up quite well in those races, that is certain. Again, you mentioned it, it's not the same as in a Grand Tour because you need to count so many other factors in there. But I feel like now's the option to next year try and build him up one level higher than that. Go one level higher, find a World Tour race that most fits his type of rider. And I'm when it comes to youngsters, I'm always looking at a Tour de Suisse kind of race, stuff like that. Or are you earlier thinking about the likes of a UAE Tour or a Catalunya? Which races do you think are the ones that he should go to? Or are we overrating his pure climbing? Probably not, eh? Like, this is a pure climber when it comes to his performances, right?
Yeah, I think he can pretty much do anything and try and get a good result already in top 10 now. He's climbing that well. I think Tour of the Alps is a nice one. Should he do a Grand Tour in his second professional year? I would say yes.
Well done.
I think he can top 10 the Vuelta pretty comfortably next year. He should probably be aiming for a top 5 in the Vuelta, to be honest, next year. And nah. You're like, why?
He's 20. Like, we can't go into the first. Age? We can't go into the first Grand Tour and say he's got a top five at his Vuelta, guys. Okay, I'm doing the same with Rodriguez and Ayuso. But, like,
everyone
he's Belgian.
Keeps
we can't put the pressure on
guys.
Him, okay?
They're
no,
ready
but
now.
It's different. It's different because Belgian Mina's going to kill this man. I don't want that to happen.
They
he
won't.
Went to
he's
Bora
lucky.
Avoiding it.
He's lucky Evenepoel exists, yeah. Imagine if Evenepoel
well.
Didn't exist. How much more hype there would have been about Lavernier. He is lucky. Because it would have been blown up so much more. He's Vuelta with Evenepoel leading has taken so much of the shine off him. Maybe that's a good thing. Maybe he lives in Evenepoel's shadow. I don't know. But yeah, top five Vuelta next year, reasonable target, I think, for him. And it's crazy when you think that he's the youngest ever winner of Tour de l'Avenir, cleaned everyone up, and he's not even the best teenage GC rider in the world. Ayuso's much better right now. Ayuso's climbing much, much faster. It's crazy.
And the reason that Ayuso didn't get the chance to fight for that same, like, name, the same plaque saying, oh, the youngest Tour de l'Avenir winner is, last year he crashed out, if I recall correctly, halfway through Avenir, after also losing some time in a crash earlier on. Like, obviously, crashes can be the rider of the, can be the fault of the rider sometimes. I don't remember the specific situation of the crash. Nor do I do it from for Uiterbrugge, because most of it was not on TV of Avenir in the earlier stages. But he came back towards the end of this Avenir and the mountain stages, he secured it. And the question then is, did Ayuso miss out on an Avenir victory there? Who knows? We can never know that. But there's also the aspect of, like,
who cares?
Exactly.
He has
matter.
A contract through 2028. He's
exactly.
Fine for the Vuelta podium.
No, gives a fuck. And there's some people that are saying, like, okay, but 50% of the people that are winning Avenir don't get to do what we are saying about a Pogacar who won Avenir, who ends up winning the Tour. Bernal who won Avenir ends up winning the Tour. Then there's Tobias Foss who was looking good when it comes to the Giro last year, being a top 10 rider there, looking pretty good in the mountains and good as a time trialist, but not necessarily breaking through this year. Kissed the floor a few times in, I think, Algarve earlier on in the season and didn't pull through at all in the Giro this year. So there's this thing where Ruben Fernandez in 2013, he's now riding, I think, for, is it Cofidis? I don't even know what it is.
Cofidis. It's age. Like,
is it age? The age at which they win it?
Yeah.
Okay.
The older winners. So here are the winners from, is in the article that also did, the 19-year-old and 20-year-old winners. Uiterbrugge, Guru, Pogacar, Miguel Angel Lopez, Quintana, Bernal, Mollema, Warren Barguil. The 21 and 22-year-old winners, Romain Sicard, Esteban Chavez, Tobias Johannesson, who was 22 the day after he won it, Marc Soler, Jan Bakalans, Foss, and Ruben Fernandez. So the younger you win the U23 race, goes without saying almost, that the better you're probably going to be in the pros. This is since 2007 when they made it a U23 race. So age matters a lot when young men are developing. Like a 22-year-old man is not the same as a 19-year-old, obviously. So if you're 19 and destroy everybody who are 2.5, 3 years older than you, you're probably pretty good. Whereas if you've been basically riding like a pro for 3 years after you finish school and you're more developed and you win, that doesn't necessarily mean you're going to kick on in the pros to the expectation. You might still be like Jan Bakalans and Esteban Chavez, and they've had good World Tour careers, particularly Chavez.
Yeah,
but doesn't mean they're going to win the Tour. So Uiterbrugge's looking good from a historical perspective. I think, there's just so much young talent. Evenepoel, Ayuso, Rodriguez.
Belgium looking good, and Spain as well.
Yeah,
is it,
Spain not Molotov.
Is it starting to feel like the talent is coming from the same countries a bit recently, like Spain, Belgium, or do you think that it's going to spread out more?
I think COVID in particular has hurt non-European countries like America, Australia. I don't know the effect of Brexit on the British riders being able to race in Europe. I presume that didn't get easier. But during COVID, it's much more difficult for the Americans and Australians or North Americans to come over. And not just them, the Colombians as well. It seems like, where are the Colombians in the Lavenir, to Lavenir.
Yeah.
Where's the Bernal Quintana? And I would say we've just had COVID starting from 2020. That's not going to have helped the non-European nations.
Wait, was there not something last year? I think there's like this whole drama last year where Colombia was not allowed to ride Avenir or something for some reason. I swear there's a drama we're missing in last year's Avenir when it comes to Colombia, but I'm not 100% certain because...
I thought that was Baby Giro, Colombia, and Britain got banned because they're too good. What a race.
Yeah,
what a
pointless race. My bad, not Avenir.
I mean, Lavenir still has its own problems. Like, there was a Colombian team there, an Ecuadorian team, an American and Australian. And listen, the Australians, like Blake Quick, he's got a contract at Bex. Jensen Plaueras got a contract at Alpecin, who will be
Portrait
World Tour. Pardon?
Portrait Bex as well, if I recall correctly.
Is he?
Yeah.
He's Dylan George has gone to FDJ Conti, so he'll be flying next year. And Matthew Dinham, I think he's 22. He'll probably get a contract too. So the Australian team, like those guys, probably they will be okay. And like the British team too, Leo Hayes and Ineos, Chloe Jumbo, and even with the American team. So I don't know. I just think it kind of helped them. And I don't know. To the Lavenir, get rid of the team time trials. Maybe we'll cover it properly. I hate the team time trials. Archie Ryan as well. Just one to watch out for. We've talked a lot about Aitha Brooks, but Archie Ryan, without the time trial, he would have been within a minute of Aitha Brooks on GC. He looks very, very good, particularly on 6% climbs. I think he could be quite good.
I think so as well. I'm just intrigued by... I think also Hesmon was really good in this race, was in the lead early, held on for quite a bit. Obviously, Aitha Brooks pulled him out of that leader jersey later on. But, well, you know what the funniest part was of Tour de l'Avenir for me as a Belgian is the fact that the Belgian Federation decided to put the U23 Belgian Championships during Tour de l'Avenir when the best Belgians are going to the Tour de l'Avenir.
What timing. What timing. but otherwise, Tour of Britain, the start list is chalk and cheese compared to last year, which had Van Aert, Alaphilippe and Hayter battling it out. No disrespect to the current guys. It's just the reality of it. It doesn't fall in as good a slot with the Australian World Champs, I don't think, to be a tune-up race. And Pidcock was the big favorite, but Corbin Strong, the Kiwi on Israel Premier Tech, won the first uphill kick, probably the hardest finish of the race. Had a Frailer, enemy's brother, Serrano fourth, Pidcock fifth, Dylan Turn sixth. So Israel obviously here for points, deluxe. And speaking of points, there was the American Maryland Classic last night, which you may have caught in Baltimore. It was nice to watch a race just in a different country for once. Actually, like even if it's not the best race, like it's just nice to watch a different race. One Dot Pro, so 200 points to the winner. It had Israel, EF, Trek, Bex lining up. No Arkea, Cofidis, Lotto, Movistar, so a big opportunity to take some points back. And EF kind of stuffed it. They had Paulus and Piccolo in a lead group of Van Mark, Zukowski, and Schoens, and they just didn't work well together. And they ended up coming third and fifth in a group of five, and then Court won the bunch sprint for sixth. So they cleaned up a lot of points, but it could have been a little bit better. It just goes to show to me, Benji, that even if you fuck up, even if you don't win these races, if they had another five of these every year, even if they would stack the top 10, just like Arkea and Cofidis do with their plethora of races, and EF would nowhere near be in the relegation discussion.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I think there's an aspect to that when it comes to the American calendar having been devoured in the last couple of years. Tour of Utah not being present, the other race, California, having disappeared. Plenty of like American one-day races that were on the calendar that are not there anymore. And I feel like it's the first U.S. classic that I've seen in a while. And it's interesting to see them in the evening because I enjoy that. Like the Quebecs and Montreal's of this world is also an evening for European people, so I don't mind watching it at that time. But there's also the aspect of there's a counter argument that an EF has the ability to also sign up for some Belgian French classics and so forth. They probably have a surface course in Europe as well somewhere. Like, do you think there's the double aspect of one, they're missing a local calendar obviously that they can benefit from, but also the fact that they didn't anticipate soon enough for getting into races in the European circuit? Because I'd argue that's also a thing, because I think there were definitely 1.1 races where they could have signed up and didn't.
Yeah, of course. They could have done done more with that. Like, I remember Vorta's at the start of 2022 was on Twitter kind of laughing about not going or having to go to quote-unquote, you know, rubbish races. So, yeah, like they won Mont Ventoux last year. They didn't send a very good team to it last year. They sent a better team to it this year. They took a lot of points. I was remiss in not saying, by the way, Maryland Classic was won by Sepp van Marck. That's his... He joined Israel in 2021. That is his first win for 3 years since Britannia Classic. So, damn, he's on a big contract, isn't he? And he's won one World Tour race. And, oh, no, I'm in 2012. In 2012, yeah, it was, wow. Crazy.
What a race. Like, Van Marck's career, watching it as a Belgian, it was really interesting because he was the upcoming guy back in the day, and seeing him beat Tom Bonin in that omloop in a one-up sprint at the end was magnificent to see. That was fantastic. The underdog, David versus Goliath, because Tom Bonin was near his prime years, not in his prime year, but near his prime years at that time in his career. And it was just fantastic to see. Now, it never came out at the top of the crop. He got so close in Roubaix so many times. And that's unfortunate to see, to the point where I feel a lot of people feel bad for Sepp van Marck a lot, because this man has had punctures on every single race he's ridden in his entire career. And I definitely think that he's had a lot more bad luck than other riders in the world. And it's unfortunate to see. And I hope that he still gets some kind of bigger classic near the end of his career somewhere. But I'm afraid that we are nearing that period, or in that period. And it's unfortunate to see that. I think he's got 1 year left at Israel. Hopefully he can do a classic here or there, because you don't know when it comes to wildcards, do you? Because Israel is likely to be demoted.
Yeah.
Are they getting wildcards, you think?
I think they get one day, so Set will be... Well, if they get relegated, who gets fired? Like, does Sylvain Adams... He can't fire himself for the Froome contract, so he can't get fired. Does Rick Verbrugge get fired for, like, signing Sepp to probably a pretty handy deal. Contract, Belgian Fuenz? Like, I don't know. They've had some bad luck, but I'm interested to see, because heads never roll in cycling. No one ever gets fired. It's not like football. Football, you have two bad years, you manage, you're out.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, you're gone. It's like performance culture. Maybe that's a bad thing. Maybe it's better that people have longer to develop because injuries happen. I don't know. Maybe I think it's a little bit too far in cycling. But we'll see. It'd be interesting to see with the relegation battle, whether UCI even go through with it. But that was our rest day recap. Bit of chat about relegation, Avenir, Vuelta. Hope you enjoyed it. And we'll see you with the Stage 16 recap tomorrow. Ciao.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.